Foundation, celebrating 10 years of support for the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston, Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or at bloodservices.org. Blood donation, it's about life.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. So what's the greatest medical milestone humankind has achieved? Anesthesia? Antibiotics? Well, readers of the British Medical Journal were asked in 2007 to vote for the most significant achievement in medicine in the last 200 years. What did they choose? Sanitation. On the program today, the scoop on poop from journalist Rose George. She's the author of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste, and Why It Matters. George reports modern sanitation has added 20 years to the average human life, yet 4 in 10 people in the world have no access. That's 2.6 billion people. They have no access, says George, to any latrine, toilet, bucket, or box. The disease toll of this is stunning. Here in the U.S., nearly 2 million people have no access to an indoor toilet. And take note of this. Advanced sewage systems are being stressed. In 1993, 100 people in Milwaukee died, and more than 400,000 were made sick by drinking water taken from Lake Michigan, contaminated with cryptosporidium. Last year, the people of Galway, Ireland, found themselves in the same boat. This afternoon, with Rose George as our guide, we'll take a look at how the world is coping or not with human waste. Rose George has written for many publications, including the New York Times and Slate. A graduate of the University of Oxford, she earned her master's degree in international relations from the University of Pennsylvania. The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters is published by Metropolitan Books, and you'll find our guest, Rose George, on the web at www.rosegeorge.com. Rose George, good to talk with you. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Well, happy International Wash Your Hands Day.
Thank you. Same to you.
You begin the book with an anecdote about yourself needing to use the bathroom. You're in a small town in the Ivory Coast. What happened?
Well, it was a little restaurant in a beach town packed with Liberian refugees, and the waiter was a young Liberian man, and I said, please, could I use your restroom? And he just indicated that I should follow him, led me off into the darkness to a room, a small building, just a one-story building, and said, here you are. And I went inside, and there was a tiled floor and absolutely nothing. I mean, no container, no hole or anything. And I was absolutely flummoxed. I had no idea what to do. So I went outside, and I asked him again. I thought maybe I was doing something wrong or missed a button or something. Mm. And he just laughed at me and he said, you know, this isn't America. You know, you just have to make do with what we've got. And then he just went off. So that was really quite a stunning experience because I was just shocked by this. I just didn't know how to cope with his attitude to me. And he thought in return that I was just being kind of spoiled and privileged and unaware of most people's situation in the world, which is, as you say, 4 out of 10 people have absolutely no sanitation, so this was quite normal.
Yeah. Was that incident what led you to write this book?
No. What led me to write this book, it was a kind of growing background noise of coming across articles about sanitation and coming across various characters like Dr. Bindeshwar Pathak, who's an amazing Indian Brahmin who has made it his life's work to liberate untouchables in India, whose job is to clean latrines with their bare hands, a really hideous job. And that's why they're untouchables. So I came across this over a few years, and then eventually it kind of formed into a compelling call that I really couldn't ignore.
Mm. You write early in the book about our discomfort in discussing this topic. Is that universal?
Some countries are more pragmatic about it than others these days. China has always been very pragmatic about using human excrement for fertilizer, and that continues to the present day. In the developed world, in the UK and the US, for example, 200 years ago, we were also much more pragmatic about it because, to be frank, we had to live amongst it more. This was before the flush toilet, so it was the era of having, you know, cesspits in your backyards. But also, it was considered a good business. There were night soil collectors who collected night soil for use on farms. So it was much more present in public discourse and thinking, and this kind of modern prudishness about it is really due to the most amazing invention of the flush toilet, which enables us to flush our waste away, but also gives us the privilege of not having to talk about it.
Hmm. When did the flush toilet arrive on the scene?
Well, some people say it arrived 4,000 years ago. In the Indus Valley in India, these ancient Harappa civilization, archaeologists have found what they think to be flushing privies, so a sort of stone privies with channels nearby for running water. And also the palace on Crete at Knossos also had sort of rudimentary flush latrines. But really what sanitation historians recognize as the sort of prototype flush toilet was invented by Queen Elizabeth I's godson in England in the mid-16th century. He was a kind of playboy dandy called Sir John Harrington, and obviously a bit of an entrepreneur as well, and he invented a flush clothes stool, as they were called, for his beloved godmother, and she apparently used it.
Mm. And then when did flush toilets become hooked up with sanitation systems?
Well, the golden age of the flush toilet was around the end of the 18th century, the 19th century, sort of the early 1800s, when there were many inventions. They invented the valve toilet, they invented the siphonic flush, the U-bend, which kept odor out of the toilet system. And increasingly over the 19th century, there were more sewers and more flush toilets until there was an event in London called the Great Stink in 1858, when the contemporary practice of discharging all latrines, privies and latrines into the River Thames had a really appalling conclusion, whereby it was so stinky that the Houses of Parliament, which are on the River Thames, contemplated moving out to the more salubrious area of Richmond. And this galvanized British politicians like it had never done before, because they were obviously directly affected by it. And an act was passed in 10 days, which was unheard of, and London had an amazing sewer system installed, which took nearly 20 years to build and has left us with thousands of miles of sewers that we're still using today.
Mm. 4 in 10 of the world's people have no access, not only to a toilet, but to a bucket or a box, no public toilet. How do they cope?
They do what human beings do very well. They just manage with what they can. But in practice, what they do is a practice called open defecation. And that means that they will use a bush or a roadside or whatever they can. They really have no alternative. In rural areas, this may be sort of acceptable. They may have a designated ground where this is done, so the fecal matter is contained. And fecal matter can be very toxic. It can carry billions of bacteria and viruses and worms. But in practice, as any of your listeners who have traveled in India will know or have taken an early morning train in India, one of the sights you see in the morning as you look out of the window is lots of, in the words of one Indian journalist, bare bottoms doing what they must. It's a dreadful situation, but there's simply no other provision for them.
Mm. Speaking of India, the title, The Big Necessity, came to you thanks to a man who builds toilets in Mumbai. Tell us about him and what he was talking about.
This man is a man called Sheikh Razak, who I actually didn't directly meet him. He was in a very good documentary about sanitation in India called Q2P. And he was interviewed as saying, you know, people in slums, they don't have very much, but they aspire to having things. And what they aspire to is having a nice apartment with a kitchen and a bathroom. But they can't afford that. So what they have, in his words, is they get the big necessity, a toilet. Now, what he does is actually not a very good thing, because he builds people flush toilets, but because there are no sewer systems, because these are unplanned areas and city authorities don't want to sort of sanction illegal squatting by giving people infrastructure. So he just connects them to the nearest open drain. So really he's contributing to the problem.
Mm. Speaking of open drains, the BBC reported yesterday that Dubai has a problem because people are truck drivers who are paid to collect waste from septic tanks are tired of waiting in line at the treatment plant to dump their cargo, so they're taking off manholes and putting it into what is the stormwater drain-off system. And it's finding its way out onto, apparently, beaches, or at least one beach so far.
That really doesn't surprise me. When you look at the world sanitation situation, 90% of sewage ends up untreated in the sea. So that doesn't surprise me that, on paper, Dubai probably has a very good system. But the actual practice, as those truck drivers are doing, is really less than ideal. It's really surprising when you look at the sanitation infrastructure worldwide. Even the most cultured, advanced cities in the world, you know, like Barcelona or Dublin or Brussels even, which is the head of the European Union, they only installed decent sewage treatment plants in 2003 or 2004. It's really quite surprising.
Yeah, in Milan. Tell us Milan's story.
Milan also, I think, it was in about 2003 that they installed a sewage treatment plant. Before that, it was treated to primary levels, which is really nothing more advanced than filtering. And it all ended up in the River Lambro. But under threat of being fined from the European Union, Milan did eventually put in a rather good sewage treatment works, but it was really only because it was about to be found guilty in the European Court of Justice.
Mm. You say in the book, talk to anyone who's trying to improve the world's sanitation, and this idea will become a refrain. We need a champion, a rock star, a movie star, a business or political star. Is there anyone on the horizon?
Well, I have great hopes for Matt Damon, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah. he already has set up an NGO called H2O, and he's doing a lot for clean water initiatives in Africa. And that's great. And recently, for the first time, as far as I know, he stood up at an event of the Clinton Global Initiative and started talking about latrines. And as far as I know, this is the first time he's done that. So he's finally made the really obvious connection, which is that it's all very well putting in clean water, but if you've got a dirty latrine that's contaminating that clean water, then you may as well, you're back at square one.
Yeah. Have you been doing many interviews? Is this a subject that people are willing to talk about?
It is, and I have.
Well, that's good.
It's great. And it's funny, actually, over the last 3 years of researching this book, you think it's a very unpalatable topic, and some people do, and I'm certainly not exhorting everybody to spend their every waking hour thinking about this. But having said that, over the past 3 years, obviously loads of people have asked me what I'm working on and have been very curious, and only three have changed the subject. Hmm. And that includes my grandmother, who's carried on talking about it, and suddenly everyone has some kind of toilet anecdote, or, you know, some kind of some strange toilet they've encountered on their travels or something. But everyone has some kind of story. And that really, I suppose, shouldn't be surprising, considering it's such a, obviously, a necessary everyday activity, but we're given no outlet to talk or think about it.
Yeah. Big necessity. Here's something surprising, or maybe not. In the budget for USAID, there is very little money for water and sanitation. And you talk with a fellow by the name of Eddie Perez, who works for something called a Water and Sanitation Program, WSP, which I believe is an NGO. But anyway, he said the health sector of USAID does not see investment in sanitation as a public health investment.
That's true. He actually works for the World Bank.
WSP, oh, does he work?
It is a program run by the World Bank, a very good one. But that's true, and that's not something that USAID is guilty of. Lots and lots of governments, in fact, nearly all governments don't prioritize sanitation. And 90%, they will have a water and sanitation budget, but 90% of that budget will generally go to water and very, very little to sanitation. Pakistan, for example, spends 47 times what it spends on water and sanitation on its military budget. You might not think this unusual, but it's just reflective across the board of a lack of priority that is given to sanitation. And yet, the World Bank and the World Health Organization have calculated that $1 invested in sanitation reaps $7 in health costs averted, or labor days that are not lost through people being ill from diarrhea or dysentery. And it's an extremely cost-effective investment.
That's quite a return on an investment.
It is. And to give you a concrete example, in Peru, Peru had a cholera outbreak in 1991, and it cost $1 billion to contain it, and it could have been prevented with $100 million invested in sanitation.
Hmm. Now, the UN is celebrating this year as the International Year of Sanitation. How's the UN doing in terms of efforts in dealing with this problem?
I think there is a bit of momentum. I mean, there have been various ceremonies decades and days before in the past. We've had three water-themed decades. We're currently in the third decade of, I think it's Water for Life. So one could be cynical about this. Also, it's also the International Year of the Potato. But having said that, I think there is real momentum. The UN Secretary General's advisor is a very diligent Prince Willem Alexander of Orange of the Netherlands, and he's a very serious guy, and he knows what he's talking about, sanitation, and more importantly, he's unafraid to talk about it. So I think in terms of sort of breaking the taboo to talk about this is one thing, and that might help increase political will, which has been sorely lacking in the past.
Yeah, and I don't think we've talked about this specifically, but give us some sense of the toll in terms of disease and death that improper sanitation results in.
Well, 1 in 10 diseases worldwide are to do with contaminated water or food, mostly contaminated by poor sanitation. But it's when you come to toddlers, children under 5, that it gets really shocking. A child dies of diarrhea every 15 seconds. And that's just really disgraceful. And sanitation kills more children than TB, malaria, and HIV, AIDS combined. And if you also, the biggest killer is respiratory diseases, and that also can be linked to poor hygiene and poor sanitation. So when you put those together, it's really an unforgivable death toll.
Yeah. So pneumonia also might be, or a disease like that might be attributable.
Also linked to poor hygiene.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Rose George. She's the author most recently of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste. and why it matters. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In the first chapter of The Big Necessity, you introduce us to four guys, Dave, Keith, Rob, and Happy. Mm-hmm. Who are they?
They are four of the 37 full-time workers who must keep London's 30,000 miles of sewers running perfectly. 37 full-time flusher men, as they're known. I think they've now increased it to 49, but nonetheless, not very many full-time staff to keep an enormous network of sewers going. But I met them in the back streets of East London, just behind the offices of one of our major newspapers, and they took me down to the Fleet Sewer, which used to be the Fleet River. And they're an extraordinary bunch of men, very funny, with a humor that's kind of mined from working in very close quarters in a very neglected niche job, and really doing their best with what is a flawed system.
How did they get into that line of work?
I think most sewer workers fall into it in a strange way. They come to it young. I mean, there are some instances of it going down, being handed down from father to son. There are second generation and third generation sewer workers, but I think it's generally it's a pretty good job. It's quite well paid. In the States, it's got good insurance, good pension, and so it's not that bad a job. It's just a question of whether you want to spend your life down sewers.
Yeah. It pays well, so then is it dangerous?
It's very dangerous. It doesn't pay that well in the States, actually, but I think the insurance is an incentive. It's very dangerous. People still die in the sewers. Two sewer workers in the States died only 2 years ago when the system flooded, because it's very vulnerable to rain, because most Western sewer systems are what is called a combined sewer system. That means they will take in stormwater and any surface water from the street, as well as what goes down our toilets, showers, and kitchen sinks. That means it's vulnerable to weather, and it really doesn't work well in wet weather. It's easily overwhelmed, even including stormwater tanks that can store excess water. Sewage overflows are extremely common. They happen every week.
Hmm. Creepy crawly things down there?
Oh, yeah. I actually only saw one rat in the London sewers, but I know this might sound strange, but I don't mind rats. But cockroaches I do have a problem with, and I did see some very large ones, which were described to me as cockroaches on steroids, down a New York regulator sewer in Queens, and I was very happy to be wearing a hard hat.
Yeah, and I bet you were very happy climbing out.
Very happy indeed.
Well, what else was it like? What did it smell like? What does it look like?
When I went down the sewer in London, I was very nervous. It was 10 p.m. at night, so it was kind of, you know, the witching hour for a start. And I had no idea what to expect. I expected that it would be absolutely stinking and just gross all around, and it really wasn't. I mean, the first sewer had been, the flow had been diverted to let us work there. So it wasn't very high. There wasn't much flow coming through. It's only about ankle level. But it didn't smell at all. I kept descending the ladder expecting to be hit by some awful odor. But really, because we chuck so much drinking water down the toilet with every flush, it's extremely diluted. And so the smell is perfectly tolerable. It's kind of damp and musty. And in the London sewers, which are the original brick sewers built by Sir Joseph Bazalgette in the 19th century, they're actually strangely beautiful. I mean, there's a reason that they're beloved of film producers and film directors, because they have very beautiful light, lovely bricks. Mm. And if you can ignore what's sloshing past your feet, then it's quite an interesting place to be.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Journalist Rose George with us this afternoon. Our topic, sanitation. She is the author of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters. Let's take some calls now. Our first listener ready to talk with us this afternoon is in Mahomet on line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm a retired wastewater worker, and so I'll say a few things positive about the job. It's microbiology, and it's very, very interesting. It changes on a daily basis, and it's very challenging. And as you mentioned, rain will affect the flow levels. It's not supposed to if it's a sanitary system, which means that it should be a tight system, and all you're doing is receiving the waste from households or industry. But over time, the joints on the sewers loosen, and then infiltration can get in. But other than that, it is a very interesting career, and every town has a wastewater plant, or the majority of towns have wastewater plants, and you always have to have somebody working there. So if somebody is interested in a job that's always going to exist, there's one. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Any comment, Rose?
Well, I have great admiration for anyone working in the wastewater industry. I think they're doing a great job, but I do think the system could do with some evolution. It has been a wonderful solution. There is no argument that the flush toilets and waterborne sewers have saved lives, but I just think it's very energy intensive, it's capital intensive, it's expensive, and we should just look at it again.
Hmm. Payoff's great, though.
Payoff is great. I'm not arguing with the fact that I love my flush toilet as much as anyone else.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line 2. Hi.
Good afternoon. Some time ago, I ran across a mention of something that was being done by a fellow in Palestine that seemed really intelligent, but I haven't heard anything about it being done anywhere else or any follow-up. This would not be something that people would take to in the United States, but in some of these other countries that you've been talking about, it's simply a squat plate that is divided so that the feces go into one container and the urine in another. And by doing this, according to what I read, it allows the urine to be used fairly immediately for fertilizer since it's customarily sterile. And by keeping the feces separate, it greatly simplifies processing those so that they can be safely disposed of and usually used as fertilizer. I was wondering if you have any knowledge about this or comment about it.
Yes, in fact, I've been writing about that this week, and in China I came across a toilet exactly as you described. It's actually called a urine diversion toilet. And as you say, it just got a little bit separated off in the toilet bowl. And it does make very, very good sense because urine contains most of the nutrients that are in our excreta. So on the one hand, isolating those nutrients makes them easier to manage because they can, in too great numbers, they can suffocate water. They can be quite dangerous. On the other hand, it can be used as fertilizer, as you say. The technology at the moment is quite immature. It is being tried out in Sweden and Switzerland and Norway, but it's really most taking off in the developing world like China and probably Palestine and India, where it just makes perfect sense because there's no existing infrastructure. So nobody really wants a flush toilet or a sewer. They don't aspire to that, and they're just happy to improve their own sanitation and get some free fertilizer.
It's not clear to me. It sounded as though what you were describing was an actual toilet where the...
Sorry, yes, no, yeah, yes, it's a squat. It was a latrine. Sorry. You can get toilets and you can get latrines. You can get both. I mean, really, you can make any kind of hardware you want.
Okay, is the toilet then, though the products are carried away in water the way we do it, does it somehow deal with them separately? I mean, in a squat plate, obviously, someone periodically empties these things and deals with it, and the toilet sounds like something automatic happens.
Well, there are two solutions. There's the one you read about and the one that I saw in China, which is indeed directly composted. It's just put into containers in a platform underneath the latrine and then directly put onto the land. But you can also, in Sweden and Switzerland, you can get toilets which can be connected to the sewer system, but only the solids go into the sewer system. The urine is diverted, and then it can be stored and then delivered to a wastewater treatment plant, but at a certain managed interval, so it's easier to control the nutrients because it's delivered at a set time, so they know what's coming and how to control the volume. So you can get both. You can get the sort of more westernized version, or you can get the composting latrine.
Okay, so the technology is actively developing in various ways.
It is. It is. There are some very keen proponents of it in Sweden and Norway and Switzerland who are working on it as we speak.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. Next we go to Oswego, line 4. Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. Interesting topic. I could say it doesn't stink, but, you know, my big concern is everybody's looking at oil and really, you know, kind of bypassing the water issue. I know there's a lot of people in a lot of countries that have bad water problems and clean, you know, basically don't have clean water. Well, we have treatments here that, and I saw this, and I can't remember the name of the channel. I want to say it was the National Channel, but they were saying where you basically, all these treatment plants that we have in this country can be cleaned up enough to where you can actually drink the water. And they showed a guy drinking the water from the treatment plants. My question was, though, since we're, especially in the Southwest, I have relatives out there that are struggling with water problems, and it's a severe, it's going to turn into the Sahara out there because they just don't get the rainfall. And the fires that are happening right now are a good example. Is there a way that maybe we can use treatment plants plus, like, desalination plants or something to get more water? There's got to be a way where we could, because I can see this becoming more expensive than gas. And I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Okay. And what about the issue of conservation?
Well, can I just say that already exists in the States, that system of recycling sewage effluent into drinking water. It's just been started in Orange County, quite controversially. But actually, a lot of wastewater treatment managers will say to you that they clean their wastewater so effectively that when it's discharged into a river, it's actually cleaner than the river water they're putting it into. So it is a possibility for water-stressed areas, and I think it will come much more into the public eye because, for example, Australia is looking at it very carefully. Israel also does it, another water-stressed country. They put it into an aquifer and then bring the drinking water out of the aquifer and say that people are less bothered by that. But it is definitely going to be a consideration in the future.
If you lived in Orange County, would you be concerned?
Sorry, are you talking to me?
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't, because on the other hand, and I hope this doesn't put anyone off their lunch, but when you think about it, we're already drinking water that goes into the same cycle. I mean, a lot of sewage effluent, cleaned effluent, ends up in bodies of water that then provide water that's used for drinking water. So really, we're already doing it, it's just that we don't want to think about it.
Yeah, it's another part of the unmentionable.
Right.
Deal. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana on line 1. Hi.
Good afternoon. This is a really interesting program. Thank you. I'm interested in compostable toilets, and they were kind of popular for a while in certain, I guess, alternative-type communities and individuals using in the rural areas. But I wondered, are compostables toilets possible to be used in urban areas, and how do they work exactly? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Composting toilets, I think it depends on local regulations, and you'd need to inquire with your local utility as to the regulations, but if a composting toilet is, if the waste is left for a certain amount of time, say 6 months to a year, various sanitation experts say it's perfectly safe and can be put on your garden if you have one. So I don't see that there's any technological difficulty in installing one. A composting toilet, you can again have various types, but the general principle is that you can have dry ones, or you can have ones that use a little bit of water to flush. But ideally, you have a dry toilet. So that's something that's quite a novelty that people would need to get used to, and that you don't have the flushing toilet. Instead, you put a layer of soil or a layer of ash or something, which is again why it's more suitable for rural areas. But I know that lots of Americans do have composting toilets, and they are popular in the Western world. It's certainly not the developing world technology. It can be done.
Let's take another call. A listener on line two. Urbana, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
One thing, on the high end, there's a farmer in Missouri who's using chicken poop on his soybeans and getting 350 bushels to the acre, which is like 3 to 4 times what I think most farmers are getting. So it certainly can be a value and replace added, you know, furnishing the nitrogen and potash and whatever that's needed for the soybeans. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I guess I'm wondering why in Africa they don't have the old outhouse, which my grandparents grew up with. It seems that this would greatly reduce health issues.
Okay, sorry, did you say in Africa?
Yes.
So you mean in places that just don't have any sanitation?
Well, the place you went to, why wouldn't they have an outhouse there?
They're just used to not having an outhouse, and they've had it for hundreds of years, and they prefer to go to the nearest bush. It's just a question of ingrained habit. But the question of what you were saying earlier about the value of human waste as fertilizer, there's no question that it's a very good fertilizer, and that's going to be an issue that's going to come more to the fore now because artificial fertilizer prices are going through the roof and phosphate reserves are finite. Some people say they're going to run out in 100 years. So using human waste as fertilizer, which the U.S. does already because it uses biosolids and that's mostly applied to land, it's unquestionably a sensible thing to do. Having said that, the biosolids debate, a lot of people are against it because they say that everything goes down the sewer system from heavy metals to pharmaceuticals to chemicals, and what we're getting is not pure human waste anymore.
And I want to thank the listener for her call. And I wonder what the challenges are for using this material in large-scale agricultural operations. Is it used?
Yes, it is in the States. 60-70% of sewage sludge, which is the dirt that has been removed from the cleaned effluent and has been rebaptized biosolids, 60-70% of that is applied to land. So it is used on a large scale agriculturally, but it is facing growing environmental protests from people who allege that it causes health problems.
And does it?
Well, there is no public record of that so far. At the moment, it's still at the level of allegation. And according to EPA, biosolids is perfectly safe. But having said that, there have been two court cases involving dairy cattle, which were fed Class B biosolids, which can contain more heavy metals. And both those cases found in favor of the farmers who had claimed that the sludge had damaged their cattle. But as yet, there is no human medical case in the public record.
And there are classifications of this waste.
There are. There's Class A or Class B. And Class A has virtually no pathogens and very regulated amounts of heavy metals, and Class B has a few more pathogens and a few more heavy metals.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Chicago, line 4. Good afternoon.
Thank you. I've heard different life-saving remedies associated with urine. Some people have, in India, used urine as a sort of medicinal aspect in their health. And other people have been utilizing some waters that certainly had the urine present. Have you ever tried or tasted any of that?
Well, you're the first person to ask me that. No, I haven't, actually, and I don't intend to. I have been in desperate moments, but not that desperate.
Well, I meant, they're talking about the urine. It's in the water tanks and other things like that. Have you tried any water from those water tanks of the toilets?
No, I haven't, but I suspect I have drunk extremely diluted and clean urine.
Aren't it a matter of waste? You've been talking about human, but the matter of animal waste is such a huge situation where we have huge cattle, livestock, beef, and pork, and other waste that's generating methane for gas utilization. But the odor is so horrific that the communities surrounding it have just virtually not having to take up gas masks or anything like that. But have you any comments on animal waste?
You know, I don't know much about animal waste. All I know about animal waste is that farmers in the UK it's less regulated than human waste, and yet no one's complaining about how much cow manure is going on in our fields.
Go ahead.
Odor is a very big problem.
Yeah.
It's kind of the biggest headache of wastewater managers.
Yeah, and as I understand it, some operations can produce more waste than cities.
Some farming operations.
Yeah. Some livestock, like feedlots and...
Oh, I'm sure.
And, So, let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. At some point, I saw that some development organizations, this was quite a few years ago, were promoting small tanks that could be where you could combine human and animal waste in developing rural areas and produce methane gas that could then be used for cooking, and then the digested waste could be used for fertilizer. Is there any word about that? I haven't heard anything about that in a long time.
I'm very glad you brought that up, because that's one of my favorite bits of the research I did. Yes, it's called biogas. And as you say, it's an underground tank that can be installed in a household, and you can hook it up to your latrine and your pigsty if you have pigs. And there's a huge biogas program in China, which I visited some villages that had taken part in it, and found some very happy farmers with a very nice free supply of energy, and it's cut down deforestation because they're not cutting down the trees for wood. It's given people enough gas to cook two meals a day, and it's given women something they didn't have before called free time. So they've got some space to do some income generation, some weaving and stuff. And at least from what I saw in China, it's a very successful program, and it makes a lot of sense. It's also being done in the Western world. The city of Lille in France, in northern France, has 10 buses that run on biomethane derived from their sewage works. So I think it has good potential as an alternative fuel.
So are there any international development organizations that are working on that you know of?
A lot of development organizations will do this, as they will have projects working on biogas. The ones I saw in China, it was actually the Chinese government that was involved, and there was a local Chinese NGO that was also promoting biogas, a wonderful organization called the Shanxi Mothers. But I know a lot of the big international organizations will have biogas programs.
Thank you.
And could I just say, one of my favorite biogas anecdotes is that in Rwanda, half of the country's prisons have biogas digesters, and they get all their food from kitchen gardens that are fertilized with prisoners' waste.
Huh. Interesting. What's on the horizon, do you think, for those of us here in the U.S.?
I think that two things that will come to the fore are the question of energy, the carbon footprint of our wastewater system, which is very recently come to public attention. In the U.K., there was a recent report whereby the Minister of Environment noted that sewage treatment uses a quarter of the energy of the UK's largest coal-fired power station. That's a considerable amount. So there's going to be a lot of effort in the wastewater industry to cut down on energy. There's also going to be the question of the fertilizer prices, which are going to become extortionate for farmers. So I think there's going to be a lot of talk about looking for alternative fertilizers, and this is the most obvious. In the US, you've got low-flow toilets already, but I think there's going to be more question about whether we can reduce the flush even more, so we're using fewer liters of drinking water with every flush. And I hope that it's just going to come more to people's consciousness, and so we will kind of notice the toilet and think about it just a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, our thanks to you for raising the issue and doing it in such an elegant and eloquent way in The Big Necessity. And our hats off to you, and I'll keep my fingers crossed for you and Matt Damon.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Rose George is a journalist, and she is the author, most recently, of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters, the publisher, Metropolitan Books. Rose George is also the author of A Life Removed, about Liberian refugees, which was longlisted for the Letter Ulysses Award for Literary Reportage. She makes her home in London. She's in the U.S. now to talk about this book, The Big Necessity. You'll find our guest, Rose George, on the web at www.rosegeorge.com. That interview from the WILL AM 580 archives. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. We talked with Rose George on October 15th of this year, 2008. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here with the numbers from the Kansas City and Chicago Boards of Trade, Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Last week, a lot of green on the boards in Chicago and Kansas City. Celeste, this week starts out a little differently. Futures were lower in Kansas City and Chicago for the wheat, as well as for the corn and the soybeans. From the wheat pit in Chicago, where they trade soft red, the nearby March lost 7.25 cents today. $6.16 the high, the low at 5.88 and a quarter. Settlement price for the March soft red winter wheat at $5.92, down 7.25. May futures, 6.27 and a half the high, the low at $6.02 a bushel, settled 6.04 and a half, down 7.25. And July, the harvest month, 6.39 the high, the low at 6.12 and a half, settlement price at 6.15 and three quarters, down 7.25. September wheat at 6.58 and a half high, low at 6.35. September soft red winter wheat settled 6.36 in Chicago, down 7.25 of a cent. In Kansas City, the March wheat futures settled 5.25 lower for the hard red at $6.11. And the spring wheat at the Minneapolis Grain Exchange settled 6.25 and a quarter, down 5.75 for the nearby March contract. From the corn pit in Chicago, March futures there, 4.23 and three quarters the high, the low at $3.90 a bushel. Settlement price for March corn in Chicago, 3.93 and a half, down 18 and three quarters. May futures, 4.33 and a half the high, the low at $4.05, settled at 4.04, down 18 and a half. In July, 4.43 and a half on the high, the low at 4.11 and a half. Settlement price at 4.14 and a quarter, down 18 and a quarter. September corn futures, 4.51 and a half the high, the low at $4.23. Settled at 4.24 and a quarter, down 18 and a quarter. And December futures in the corn pit for next year, 4.67 and a half the high, the low at 35. Settlement price at $4.38 and a quarter, down 18 and a quarter. March oats today, 2.37 the high, the low at 2.13 and a quarter. Settlement price at 2.17, down 14 cents. And the May at 2.45 and a half high, low at 2.26. Settled at 2.26. On that low, down 14 cents. From the soy complex, January beans nearby contract, 976 and a quarter on the high, the low at 930 and a quarter. Lead option January soybeans settled $9.38 and a half a bushel, down 13 and a quarter. March futures, 981 the high, the low at 936. Settlement price at 945 and a half, down 11. And the May contract in the bean pit, 992 the high, low at 948, settlement price at 957 and a quarter, 10 and one quarter lower. July soybean futures, $10.03 the high, the low at 960, settlement price at 968 and a half, down 10 and a quarter. And the November soybeans, $10 and a penny and three quarters the high, the low at 965, settlement price for the new crop soybeans at $9.74. down 5.5 cents. January bean meal futures, $304.50 the high, the low at 291. Settlement price at $292.10, down $5.60. March contract, 304.10 the high, the low at 290.40. And a settlement price at $291.50 a ton, down $5.50. January bean oil, 33.65 the high, the low at 32.04. Settlement price there at 32.21, down 61, and the March bean oil, $34 the high, the low at 32.35. Settlement price at 32.53, down 59. In just about 11 minutes, I'll return with the closing mark report this afternoon. We'll talk with Kurt Kimmel. He's the senior grains analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And then the folks at the Andersons will join us from right here in Champaign County to take a look at the cash grain market. And as we close out that half-hour-long program, we'll talk about the agriculture agricultural weather forecast with the people up at Chesapeake Energy on the 22nd floor of the Boeing Building in Chicago. I believe Mark Russo should join us. Stay with us for the 2 o'clock hour, and we'll bring you the closing market report. Just a quick reminder what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade. Wheat futures were off 7 to 8 cents today. Corn futures down 16 to 18 cents. And the beans in the nearby were down 10 to 13. The deferreds down 3 to 5 cents. And that's a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade and the Kansas City Board of Trade. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Now let's take a look at what happened today in Chicago at the Merck with the livestock contracts. A higher day today for the livestock contracts. December live cattle, 86.40 the high, the low 85.85, the settlement 85.97 and a half, that up 7 and a half. February 86.90 the high, 86.15 the low, 86.20 the settlement, that up 10. April 89.80 the high, 89.05 the low, 89.35 the settlement, that up 50. June live cattle, 86.20 the high, 85.35 the low, the settlement 85.90, that up 97 and a half. January feeder cattle, 93.80 the high, 92.90 the low, 93.45 the settlement, that up 62 and a half. March, 93 even the high, 92.20 the low, 92.85 the settlement, that up 110. April, 94.10 the high, 93.30 the low, 93.87 and a half the settlement, that up 117 and a half. May feeder cattle, 95.30 the high, 94.30 the low, finishing at 95.30, up 120. February lean hogs, 59.75 the high, 58.95 the low, 59.15 the settlement, that up 20. April, 67.65 the high, 66.82 and a half the low, the settlement 67.52 and a half, that up 80. May, 77.80 the high, 77.30 the low, the settlement 77.80, up 30. And June, 78.72 and a half the high, 77.95 the low, 78.30 the settlement, that up 30. February bellies, 88.30 the high, 87 even the low, 87.45 the settlement, that down $1. The Dow off 109 at 8407, the Nasdaq off 30 at 1499, make that 1500. The S&P 500 off 9 at 864. Oil up 224 in New York at the Mercantile Exchange there to 39.97. It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director is Henry Frain. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. Let's take a look at Dan Pounder's forecast for Champaign-Urbana this afternoon. Sunny and breezy, the high 48, the wind out of the west at 12 to 24 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy, the low 28. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and windy, the high 49. The wind tomorrow out of the southwest at 20 to 30 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy and windy with a few flurries possible, the low 20. Wednesday, New Year's Eve, sunny and colder, the high 29. Wednesday night, partly cloudy, the low near 20. New Year's Day in Champaign-Urbana, look for partly sunny skies with a high of 36. This afternoon in Illinois and Indiana, mostly sunny and breezy, highs ranging from 39 north to 54 south. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows from 22 in the north to 33 in the south. The outlook for tomorrow in northern areas, increasing cloudiness with a chance of light snow and flurries late elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny and windy, highs tomorrow ranging from 34 in the north to 56 in the south. As we're coming up on 2 o'clock Central Time, it's 45 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Coming up tomorrow in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, another interview from the archives. We'll revisit a conversation we had with Gary Paul Nabhan, research social scientist with the Southwest Center, University of Arizona. He is also a founder and facilitator for Renewing America's Food Tradition.